Welcome to Spacers. This week we have Sam Richard, UI architect for IBM's Watson, on the show. I had an amazing talk with him. It's just also, I've been friends with him for a while, but it's wonderful to see since he's been working on the web. So it's been really awesome to hear about his background and get into that a lot. Also, we talk about his new SAS linting tool as well. So definitely, if you use SAS, check it out. But it was so awesome to see that how much he's done in a short period of time, helping governments, agencies, government organizations, and also big companies have better empathy for their users, as well as also for engineers and designers alike. So, and the thing is, like, he's mostly an engineer too, so he's, you know, has that empathy for designers and for the front end, which is crazy awesome. So. Some show notes, some things going on with my life. I'll be hosting the UX Rebels Summit. It's an online conference on November 17th. It's great for free, UX freelancers and professionals, or freelance professionals. So check it out at uxrebelssummit.com. And get tickets are like $99. You know, it's pretty cheap. You can get like six sessions and all the recordings with that too. Also, you know, we're talking with Sam Richard about SAS. So I'm also hosting the SAS Summit on November 18th and 19th. So it's right after the UX Rebel Summit. So it's sassummit.com. It's 2 days filled with awesome SASY sessions. And actually, Sam is speaking there too. So check it out. I hope to see you there. As for Not Breaking Space, please subscribe via iTunes. Go to the iTunes, do a podcast search for the Non-Breaking Space show, and subscribe. That way you always get the latest show. And while you're there, please give us a 5-star rating, if you don't mind. Just let us know what we're doing, what you guys think of the show. Really appreciate it. It helps, you know, a lot of effort to put on the show. It's not myself. It's also Chris Enns and also Sam Kapp, who can't be here all the time, but she helps out a lot. So, and also, if you're a fan of the show and don't mind doing a little voice work for us, just doing some bumpers in here and there, I think it'd be kind of fun just to get some other voices into the mix as well. Just give us a holler at our Twitter handle it's at NBSPTV on Twitter, and just let us know if you're up for it, and we'll get in touch with you. That's it for now. Enjoy the show, and see you next week. So what you about to recently?
So I just got back from JSConf EU, where I gave a talk on cognitive computing and how things like Watson, which is where I work, can change the way that we think about user experiences for apps.
Okay. How so?
So things like really the goal of cognitive computing is to be able to provide to be able to work on kind of human complex problems that traditionally need humans to kind of figure out, using human natural input and output. So, probably the best known example of a cognitive application is a personal assistant like Siri or Google Now, where you can speak into it. It'll figure out what you mean. It'll find the answer, then it'll speak the answer back to you. Yes, that's a personal assistant pattern that we see a lot of, and that's kind of like the first cognitive application everyone's been introduced to.
Okay. Yeah, sort of like Siri or Alexa or something like that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or the Whopper from War Games.
Yes.
Okay. Cool. So anything interesting that, or like any highlights from your talk, or do you want to not give it away?
Well, so the video will be posted soon because JSConf does an awesome job posting all their videos. I built a fun little app that is speech-to-speech translation. So you speak in English, and then it translates to like French, and then speaks it back in French. So that you hold not real-time conversation, but pretty close to like real face-to-face conversations in native languages. And then I showed off Chef Watson, which is always fun to show off, which I didn't build, the team at IBM built. But Chef Watson is cooking with cognitive capabilities. And there is this great little, the idea of Chef Watson is we ingested Bon Appetit's recipes and the chemical compounds of all the ingredients and kind of let Watson go to work on it. So it's been able to find connections we wouldn't otherwise be able to see. And the interface is something like you say you want to use this ingredient and this ingredient, and it invents a recipe for you. And I did a call out from the audience, and because I was at a tech conference, the first ingredient was bacon.
Of course, right.
And then
not get away from bacon, yes.
Yeah, I know. And then the second ingredient someone asked, or someone called out, was soy sauce.
Okay.
Right. And then Chef decided that it knew where we were going. And decided to pair bacon with more bacon. Because, of course, if you have bacon, you need more bacon.
Bacon, soy sauce, let's go back to bacon.
Yeah, pretty much. And then it had the greatest bug ever, something that I absolutely positively could never reproduce ever. But what it was, it decided to give us undefined dumplings as the recipe. And it's so perfectly at a JavaScript conference. Bacon.
Explain that, dude.
At undefined dumplings. It gave us undefined dumplings.
So was that a recipe, or did they just like, I'm just going to drop you here at undefined dumplings?
Well, so there was a recipe to it. It was the title of whatever the recipe it generated. Oh, okay. Right. But the title part came back undefined.
So the recipe, the ingredients were double bacon, soy sauce, anything else? I don't know what the connections were.
When you dive into the recipe, it gives you a whole recipe.
Yeah.
We did it at the end of the talk, and I don't remember what came out of it at the end of the
That's pretty awesome, though.
It came up with undefined bacon. Undefined dumplings was the best.
That's awesome. That is pretty good. That's pretty sweet. Cool, man. So you work at IBM Watson. I think it's probably one of those probably high-profile projects IBM has. Now, I guess I hate to say that out loud because I might be embarrassed because I might be another IBM project I don't know about that I should know about. So, so how did you, how did you get to IBM Watson? And then I guess you want to start from the very beginning, like how did you get involved into the web? And then how did you end up working with the Watson team?
Yeah, sure. So, Watson is one of our highest profile projects at IBM. There was just an announcement last week, I think, a project called Outthink, which is our vision of like the future cognitive business, which centers around Watson a lot. That's where I work. My journey into web development is interesting. After college, I wound up getting a job with the New York State Senate. And I had originally applied for a developer position, but they didn't have any available. They were looking for someone with a little bit more experience than me. So I wound up taking a job as essentially a print project manager for a couple of the state senators. And while I was there, I kept in good contact with the CIO's office. And like one of the first things they did was they sent me to a Drupal training. Drupal is a PHP-based content management system.
It's one of the most popular ones, right?
Yeah, and the Drupal community actually just released the RC of Drupal 8, which is the next version of Drupal. So that's pretty exciting for the community. I got sent to a Drupal training, like one of my first weeks on the job. And after about 2 or 3 months being a print PM for our couple senators.
Print PM is project manager or print?
Yeah. So I was a project manager for print jobs for our senators.
Did you have print background beforehand? Or?
No, none. It wasn't so much. I didn't so much need a print background as I needed to be able to control requests coming in from senators and say, yes, you have the budget to go print this.
So the key master of the flow of requests and stuff like that. So make sure and be able to be polite and tell senators from New York to like, no.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's the main responsibilities. Okay, cool. Awesome.
My job basically was to be the gatekeeper in Basecamp.
Right.
And then after a couple months doing that, a position opened in the CIO's office. I kept up with the CIO's team, went and checked and visited on them. And they basically took a chance on me as a developer. And I started as a back-end developer with them working on the New York State Senate website. The CIO at the time was a guy named Andrew Hoppin. And the guy who was like the lead tech evangelist, I guess is the way, a good way to describe his role, was a guy named Noel Hidalgo. Both people who have been in the Drupal community for a long time, in the open source community and open gov community for a while, and both still are. And then my developer there was a guy named Sheldon Rampton. And between Sheldon and Noel, they basically taught me how to do PHP development in a Drupal world. And I started off as a backend developer. And I did that for a couple of months. I built one feature there. Yeah.
So what tricks or tips do you have to be a PHP developer in a Drupal world that you've
Yeah, so the best trick I can give you to being a PHP developer is always have the PHP docs open.
Okay.
The every single PHP developer I know, from the most junior to the most senior, no one has anything memorized. Everyone just uses the PHP docs.
Okay. So,
use the PHP docs. They are your friend. And IRC. IRC was a big learning tool for me. Being able to just kind of jump into a conversation and ask a question and get an answer was great, especially the Drupal community.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
But so you're a couple months into Drupal and they taught you PHP development. And so that's where you were?
Yeah, so that's where I was. And then we got this project to take the summer reading program that the New York State Senate runs and move it from paper to online to build the very first web-based version. Mm-hmm. And I kind of became a full stacky developer for that. At the time, it was right around when Drupal 7 came out. So there was a lot of like new ground to cover. Mm-hmm. And I also learned about responsive web design. And around that time, it was about a year, maybe a little bit less after the article came out.
So that would be what, 2000? I don't know. What year would that be? 2011?
5 years old at this point, I think.
2010? Okay.
Yeah. So maybe 2010, 2011, something like that is when I was building this.
Okay.
Right? That sounds right. So I really wanted to build this responsively because I kind of had a feeling even then that this was something big and this is something that needed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And through kind of the full stack work I did there, I did some of the design work too, which if you've seen me try and do design since then, imagine me early in my career doing that. And it worked really well and it got me like this big love of the front end. And I found the challenges of the front end were a lot more interesting than the challenges of the back end because they involved users. They involved different ways that people could interact with something, but it also involves, it's not just a static system more or less. It's like constantly dynamic and changing. And that really intrigued me as a set of problems. And it also scratched my designery photography itch. So I kind of glommed on to front-end development after that project. And then from there, I worked for a digital agency.
So I just want to spend, so what type of user like input did you get any user feedback from that? Did you have to make any changes? Did you like, because you're building this summer reading program or?
Yeah.
And then like, so how did you, like, did you build something and someone said like, oh, you're not building it for the users or you just were aware of front end support from it?
Yeah. So we had a pretty, the summer reading program had been going on for a very long time.
Okay.
It was basically transferring the experience of filling out a form with the books that have been read from a paper form to an online form.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't do any real user research or get a lot of user feedback. It was mostly internal to the team, but we had a strong idea of what they were, what like the flow needed to be already. Mm-hmm. But the user feedback we got after it had launched and after it was done for the summer was really positive. Everyone really seemed to enjoy it who participated in it. And if I remember correctly, even after I left the Senate, they kept the website running for multiple years. So it seems to have done well.
Right. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it's still around. Cool. Yeah. So you had more of a love of a front end after that. And where'd you go from that project?
Yeah. So from there, that was the last project I did at the Senate. And then I moved to a digital agency. And I worked there for a couple months before finding Noel again at the World Economic Forum. So then I moved and I worked for the World Economic Forum, working on an internal CMS or CRM type system. And that's where I really learned. That's the first time I had worked with a real designer directly on a project, someone who I could sit next to. And I learned a lot from that experience. That experience taught me, kind of formed how I understand pair design and how I understand. It was like it laid the foundation for me to be able to speak in the design world, not just the tech world. So the designer I worked with was a guy named Cameron Barrett, I believe was his last name.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Cameron?
Can you describe him?
He's kind of a bit tall, biggish white guy with bald head.
Yes, that's him.
Yes, yeah.
Cool. Cameron. Yeah, last time I saw him, he was at South by Southwest. I think it was like Gore versus Bush hadn't happened yet, but he was working on Democratic campaigns for the blogging and for their just, I think blogs are big back then. And so he was doing consulting for them. So that's awesome. Cool.
Yeah. So Cameron was the first designer I worked with kind of side by side. And the way that I teach pair design now and the way that I practice pair design really came from my interactions with him.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, about to explain it. Yeah. Sorry.
So what we wound up doing is we were working on this and he knew that he hadn't done HTML in a while, but that he wanted to like iterate quickly in HTML. And I knew that I could iterate quickly in HTML. So we would literally sit next to each other at the same computer. And we would push pixels around together and he would be my eyes and I would be the hands and we would work together and collaborate and kind of bounce off each other. Until we found what we liked and it worked really well. And that's how we did it responsibly too. Cause that was the big thing that I was pushing for. That worked fantastically.
Cool.
Yeah.
So is that by pair design, you mean just is it just working with a designer and developer at the same desk and computer? Is that what it is? And I'm just
So the way that I don't know if pair design is the right word. Pair design is the word I've been using for a couple of years now, but it's the idea of pair programming, except instead of you pairing with another developer, you pair with a designer as a front-end developer and work together to create the experience in the browser. So it's not a designer going off and coding in browser on their own necessarily, but it's really a partnership. When I brought this to NBC, which was my next stop, our designer had an idea in their head, but then through being able to play with it and see it in browser, and my knowledge of how CSS works, we're able to really refine that design into something that works and is responsive and is performant. It doesn't necessarily need to be shoulder to shoulder because sometimes we work remote, but it's sharing a computer and working together.
Right. So like you're working in the browser, which is a big thing, getting away from Photoshop comps. I mean, you can still use Photoshop, but it sounds like the idea is just to build in the round, if it's, you know, like kind of like what I say, like build around, build in the browser, build where it's going to actually, design's going to live, and then be able to also circumvent the whole, like, you know, the big brick wall of throwing a design over, you know, over brick wall to the programmer, and then the programmer throws it back and forth until you guys figured it out. Sounds like, so that's kind of like you short circuit that whole, you know, production cycle and just, you know, just zero in and make it and try to get a product, you know, together or design that works, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely what it does. It also short circuits the knowledge transfer time. It does all, it does a hell of a lot to build empathy between design and engineering.
There's a lot that needs to be done for that.
Yeah. So it's one of the best ways I've seen to build empathy, because it's not just throwing stuff back and forth. It's you're working together on the same thing at the same time.
Right. And that's what you want to have, is like making sure everyone's working on the same project and to a same goal. Right. So, yeah. And that way you build a good partnership, you know, not just for that project, but for future projects as well.
So yeah,
that's awesome. Yeah. That's great. That's awesome. Cool. Yeah. Cause like when I first started out, when, doing the programmers were just like, you know, when we had that whole like waterfall, like type thing, where just, we throw the design over, you know, the programmers, you know, if there's something you didn't, as a designer, if there's something you didn't, plan for, but you needed to, and you didn't have a comp for it, but the programmer knew that you needed it or something like form, action, response, whatever. I would call my programmers would just say like, yeah, it works. So it's like, yeah, it just doesn't look like anything else on the rest of the site, but you're totally right. It does meet the definition of I can eat it and I will not die from it. So it's not poison, but we need to make sure it's in the same, you know, genre of food that we're delivering to the user. So that's a food analogy, which I'm famous for. So everyone, but yeah, so but cool. Cool. So, so you went from the World Economic Forum,
yep,
to NBC. So how long were you at World Economic Forum? Like, you just like, was it easy transition?
I was there, maybe a little bit less. They wound up winding down the development team I was on, which is why I wound up moving.
Yeah.
Then I moved to NBC, where I worked with, or on the NBCU Tech Publisher 7 team. Publisher being a custom configured version of Drupal 7 that we use for the brand websites. Mm-hmm. And brand being core team building.
So brand being
like NBC.com or Sci-Fi or Telemundo or USA Network.
Okay, cool.
So I didn't work on the actual implementations of brands per se, but I worked on kind of like the front end technology and stack and standards to be used for those implementations.
Okay, cool. And then did you get involved in SaaS at some point while you're at NBC?
Oh, yeah. SaaS, that thing.
Yeah. Because that's how I know you, is like a lot from SaaS, but also.
Yeah.
From SaaS, and that's how I first met you. It was like through that.
Yeah. So SaaS, I got involved with SaaS back in the New York State Senate days. I was using it on the summer reading program website. And that summer I was in London for a Drupal conference, and I really wanted to talk about SaaS because I had just found SaaS and I was all excited and I wanted to learn more. So I made like a couple birds of a feather sessions, kind of like non-official sessions I made one to talk about SaaS. And this was back in the day that I didn't really know much about SaaS. I really was learning. But I wound up, most of the people there knew less than me. So we wound up I wound up needing to teach SaaS a little bit, which was fun. And I really enjoyed that. And I wanted to do it again. So I submitted a SaaS talk to New York's Drupal Camp 10, which was that year. And it turns out that Claudina Sarai, who you may know from history as the person who she and I co-founded the SaaS conference, she had also submitted a SaaS talk. And the organizers of that conference said, we don't want two SaaS talks. But if you two work together to give one, we'll give you twice the time.
Okay.
So the two of us wound up giving one joint SaaS talk at this Drupal camp. And it went over really, really well. And we kind of became fast friends from that and started organizing SaaS stuff around New York City. Yeah, and from that organizing of the New York SaaS Drupal community grew the organizing of SaaSConf. Took a couple years from when we started that to get it off the ground. But our first SaaSConf was 2 years ago. Our third one's this year in Austin in like 3 weeks. I'm not organizing it this year, but Claudina still is. So yeah, I got involved with SaaS. One of the things I was really looking forward to with SaaS, I had this crazy idea in my head that I could generate content-based media queries programmatically, based on, like, I started learning a lot about typography. And this idea that I could figure out when I should have a media query based on known typography parameters and like some math around the measure. And it worked really well for individual fonts, but I didn't quite know everything about fonts and font metrics and stuff like that at the time. But I dove really, really hard into SaaS. Right when like the first SaaS 3.3 beta came out, whatever year that was. Because that was the first time you could create media queries from variables. So like the moment that was available, I wrote my first bit of code to make my kind of like mad dream of programmatic content media queries come true. And at the end of the day, it didn't really, like, it worked, but squishing your browser until your content no longer looks good works so much better. But from that came Breakpoint, which is a SaaS plugin that probably a lot of people know.
Yeah, I think that's like the most popular one. I think I keep on, you know, people need to use it for, like, that's one of the reasons why people use SaaS, I think, is just to get to the breakpoint so they can build responsive websites, right?
It's just, yeah. So Mason Wendell and I built Breakpoint together. And then around that same time, a couple months later, Scott Kellum wrote something called Singularity, which was a grid framework whose purpose was to allow asymmetric grids and kind of content-first grids. Very early days of that, back when a grid set app first kind of launched. And then Scott and I worked together on Singularity, so I wound up doing a lot of work on both Breakpoint and Singularity to kind of give me that the responsive stack that I wanted.
Is Singularity still in development, or is it still?
Singularity is still in development. It's been really stable for a while, so there haven't been updates, and there haven't been need to be updates, but it's still stable. Still stable, still usable, still have teams. The documentation is a little bit bad. We've been meaning to update the documentation for a while, and we just haven't had time. But yeah, Singularity is still in development.
Right. And I will say, like, you know, I've told you this a million times before, but I love your Singularity talk that you give, that you gave. I don't think you give it anymore, but there's a period, like, I think I saw it three times in 1 year, and I loved it each time. I was just like, oh, this is so, because you go through the design history. I mean, there's a lot of respect for the design history, you know, web design challenges, and then just like this whole, like, oh, by the way, I got this like solution that won't kill you. You have responsive web design layouts for asymmetric web design layouts. So I was like, oh my, this is so beautiful. So definitely if you get a chance, I would just, if you look it up, that'd be great. I think we have it somewhere at E4H2, somewhere right there. And Breakpoint, I love the, I think it's almost like kind of universal tool if you're using SaaS, but I do love the Breakpoint movie references on the website too. So just the nice pop culture references, not the new movie Breakpoint, but the original classic.
That's all Mason.
Yeah. So that's awesome. So you've evolved in SaaS, that's SaaSConf. it was like 2 years, I think, in New York City, right? Yeah. And now it's in Austin this year. I think it's, is it 3 weeks away? Is it?
It's November 11th through 14th.
All right. So, okay. So it's pretty close from when we're recording this, but not too close away. So cool. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. And it's in Austin. So it's my backyard. So I'm really, really happy to look forward to seeing everyone come back there. So cool. And that's at sasconf.com for more details for that. So, and are you heavy with SaaS right now, or are you still on, like, what's your relationship with SaaS?
So I still use SaaS. I still love SaaS. I've moved away from things like prefix mix-ins and some of the like known transformation stuff like prefixes. I now use post CSS for, or specifically like auto prefixer. But I still write in SaaS, and I still maintain in SaaS, and, only things that, are that style of transformation, not changing the work that I've written, but, expanding on the prefixes or like kind of the grunt cleanup-y type work is things that I'll let post processors do. Anything that's maintenance or anything that's like direct transformy type things like mix-ins, I still do in SaaS. But recently I became a co-maintainer of Gulp SaaS, which is the Gulp plugin, for Node SaaS, or Gulp plugin that ties into Node SaaS, which ties into Lib SaaS.
Okay.
So I've been maintaining that for a couple months now, and I started a all Node SaaS linter, which I will be talking about at SaaS Summit. And I've been very fortunate to have two awesome guys in the UK named Ben Griffith and Dan Purdy. Forgive me if I get their names wrong. Who saw this and saw that I had kind of like a basic scaffolding done with some basic rules and said, hell yes. And now basically have written, they've combined written more SaaS lint than I have, which is the power of open source. And I love it. And I'm like, it's great. Cause we now have, SaaS lint now pretty much has all of the, rules that the Ruby based SCSS lint, comes with. More or less, we're still missing a handful, like five or so. But it will lint SASS and it will lint SCSS syntaxes.
And just for people who don't know, like lint is, how would you describe lint? Why would I need to use SAS lint? You know?
So SAS linting, and I'm going to go into more of this in my talk, but SAS linting is, or linting in general, is a way to ensure that through static code analysis, so not running your code, but just kind of looking at what your code looks like, ensure things like potential, you don't accidentally write things into your code that could be potential bugs or cause potential errors. And also, optionally, like check to make sure a style guide is followed. So a good example of somewhere where a potential bug may crop up is when you're writing SAS, generally, you want to write custom properties after mixin declarations in case a mixin adds a property. And if a mixin adds a property that you've already declared, then that mixin will override the property you've already declared. And you probably don't want that. You probably want to overwrite the mixin.
Right.
So SAS lint has a rule that says mixins before declarations, I believe is what it's called, or mixins before properties, maybe. To ensure that if you've written a declaration or a mixin before or after a property, it will prop up in your console and it'll say, hey, look, you did this. You probably shouldn't do this. Here's the line and the column to go fix it.
Yeah, mixin before properties is my tramp stamp, by the way, as well. You know, cool. Yeah, so that's awesome. So we're going to be talking about that at SAS Summit and more details with that. So, but I do, like you mentioned, post CSS in there. And so that's relatively newish, I guess, in terms of, you know, CSS processing and some of that. So can you like describe what that means, post CSS?
I will do the non-opinionated version.
That would be great.
Post-CSS describes itself as a post-processor for CSS, okay. Where you just write CSS and then let it transform things for you. Yes. And it does it through plugins. The most popular plugin, I would say, far and away, is AutoPrefixer. Mm-hmm. That you write just, for instance, you can write transform, translate X 100 pixels. Right. And it will take can I use data, which is browser support and browser usage, combine that with what properties you've used, and spit out the vendor prefixes that you need. So it'll transform, it will take translate X and turn it into WebKit transform and Moz transform and MS transform as needed. Yeah. Which is really fantastic for those types of transforms.
Right. So just let me rephrase it and let me know if I'm wrong. It would take the standard way that browsers should run things, and then in terms of properties and values that's in the spec, let's say, and then it goes back and then spits out the vendor prefixes. Is that right?
Yeah, auto prefixer does that. Yeah.
Okay. And so that's what post CSS does, or did I just miss that?
So post CSS, at the end of the day, my understanding of it is it's a really fast AST for CSS, AST being abstract syntax tree. So when we're talking about linting, what we're really talking about is turning a file into basically a giant tree, or you can think of it as a giant object that describes what each and every word basically in a file is, and their nesting and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's an abstract syntax tree. So PostCSS creates an abstract syntax tree, and it also has a plugin system that allows people to write plugins to read from the tree and act on the tree to write to change the tree. So the auto prefixer plugin for PostCSS finds places where you have non-vendor prefixed properties, figures out if you need a vendor prefix, inserts the vendor prefixes, and then you have a new tree that can then be flattened down into a file.
Wow. Okay. So I get to see I guess I have to see more, but I just feel like that's like a lot of potential for just blowing stuff up and doing some really cool stuff that you would not normally not be able to.
Yes. So some of the other plugins for PostCSS are like, use all of the SAS syntax you already do, just compile it through PostCSS, which works for simple things like variables and mix-ins. Right. Doesn't work so well for things like extends, because the extend syntax is very specific and particular and has lots of edge cases. But for simple things like variables and mix-ins, it becomes easier. The place where it starts to get a little bit weird and why I still prefer SAS is everything's a plugin for PostCSS. So if you start to rely on multiple plugins to construct the meta language that you're writing in, there's no like unifying direction or single direction for how that works, which means it might not work well together, and you might have a hard time kind of maintaining it and working with it on teams. It allows for some things that I really don't like transparent mix-ins. So create your own property with your own values that don't exist in the spec and probably won't exist in the spec, and have it magically transform into other properties. That to me is kind of a smell, because it makes it really hard for someone to track down what's happening. And it's something that's been rejected from SAS, which I think is a good thing, but other people might not.
Okay. So, before we went to post CSS, I think you're still at NBC Universal.
Yeah.
And so, and from what I got, you went from NBC Universal, you're doing like some awesome stuff there. Like you're doing documentation like North, right? That was, how would you describe North?
So, I think the story around North is fun. So, yeah. I had a my manager at NBC at the time I wrote North was a woman named Morgan Evans. And Morgan comes to me in November of that year and goes, Sam, so it looks like we need, or I've been asked to have our development standards, our front-end development standards, written like 2 weeks ago. Do you think you can do it? I'm like, yeah, sure. So North started as the web development section of using HTML5, accessibility. I did some research with some developers to come up with kind of my take on BEM that I use today, which has changed its name to Scale, but it's still often referred to as the Point North version or CSS naming syntax. So it started off as those dev docs, but then it kind of expanded into everything that I've learned so far, kind of a giant brain dump of everything that I know that I hold to be true for what it takes to do modern web development. And it covers everything from content, like high level overviews, but content strategy and project management and design and user experience and responsive web design and performance and style guides. It kind of covers the whole gamut.
That's a massive brain dump, right?
It's a massive brain dump. I think I printed it out as a PDF once and it came out to be about 100 pages.
So, wow.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a massive brain dump of just stuff. And it's a couple years old at this point, but a lot of it still holds true and I still get some decent feedback on it. Of people really liking it as like a starting point of the things you need to consider when you start down this development process. So yeah, that's what it is. It's pointnorth.io. I just got an email auto renewing the URL, so it should be still up. and it's all open source.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. So that's what it is.
Cool. And then, so how did you get to NBC to NBC to IBM?
So I was at a conference and I met a senior developer, a guy named Kevin Settle, and one of the IBM design recruiters at a conference I was speaking at. And a couple months later, they reached out to me to ask to see if I was interested. And I heard them out, and they wound up connecting me to the design executive for the Watson Group. And they wanted me to come and be the UI architect for the Watson Design Group and kind of and architect what our pattern library would be, like the thing that drove Watson user interfaces. And that sounded interesting to me. So I accepted the position. And I joined Watson not this May, but the previous May. Yeah.
2014?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I've been working there since.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah, and then they're based in Austin, right?
Yeah, so the Watson, the IBM design group is two floors in the IBM complex in Austin. So I wound up going to Austin a lot to kind of hang out with them and do some work there. And most of the Watson design group is in New York, or is in Austin, I should say. But Watson itself, last October, we opened up Astor Place, 51 Astor Place in New York City, which is, I believe it's still the global home of Watson.
And global home for Watson. That's good.
Yeah, like Watson core technology, that's the home for Watson, or the corporate home for Watson. And because we've got a big presence in New York, and yeah, so we've got for a while there wasn't a lot of designers there, but we now have Watson engineering there, we've got Watson marketing, Watson sales, Watson ecosystem, a bunch of our execs are here. Yeah, so it's great. And we're in Astor Place, which is right by the East Village of New York. So it's this great young neighborhood in Silicon Alley, basically. I think Facebook and AOL and J.Crew are across the street.
Oh, man. Cool. Sweet. That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
So, and so you've been there for a year. It's been, you know, and it's an awesome to see you in Austin more often.
Yeah.
So that's pretty awesome. So that's a perk I get for you for working for IBM. So I'm pretty sure it's not on the, you know, the brochure wear at IBM design. So I get to hang out with Chris more often. Oh, cool. Well, that's right. Cool. So you've been in the industry for a while. You've done like a lot of cool things. You know, I think the, from the north, this is a massive brain dump of great things to work on a project. What do you see as for our industry? I'm just interested in your point of view of like, what challenges do you see in our industry going forward?
So the biggest challenge I see, and I kind of work with every day, is how to produce great user outcomes. And I know that sounds super marketing-y and super like busy business-y, but the biggest challenge that we have, and we see this with Google's AMP and with Apple News and with whatever the Facebook version of it is we as an industry have gotten really comfortable building very pretty things. Mm-hmm. And we as an industry have gotten, aren't doing a great job with performance, and user experience is a big part of performance. So, or performance is a big part of user experience. So sometimes our user experience suffers. And I saw it at NBC. I saw it at the forum. I see it now at IBM. I see it when I talk to people.
Can you explain the difference between performance and music UX? Because like performance, like, you know, I just came from I've been a part and like at least two talks about performance in terms of it was a page weight, you know, that was mm-hmm. like file size. Is that what you're talking about? Or
so for me, performance is more than page weight. Performance is page weight is a measurable aspect of performance. But what's more important than page weight to me is perceived performance, how quickly user interface feels to a user. Okay. So while page weight's important, a much better indicator of if you're going to build like a performance budget that I use is something called speed index, which is, I believe the official term is it's the average amount of time it takes to get like the majority of the content rendered on a page. So you can have a really, really heavy website, mm-hmm. but if you can get someone interacting with your content very quickly, and they can see and interact with your content quickly, then it's not okay that it's large, but you are working better for the user and you're providing a better user experience than if you just wait for that whole big thing to load before a user can start working.
Okay.
So performance is things like how do you handle the flash of unstyled or invisible text?
Right.
Or like how long does it take for your interface or for your application or for your website to respond to user input?
Yeah. So, like what do you mean by how long it takes to respond, like just to read it or to click on something or not click away? I don't know.
So there's this great article, about how Instagram works with performance and kind of deals with how performance works in the app. I don't remember what it's called off the top of my head, but basically
is that the one where like it works on in the background to upload a photo and it's just this,
yeah.
just waiting for you to click okay, because then it's like, oh well, I've already sent it, you know.
Yeah. So exactly. It uploads the picture in the background when you're applying filters and tagging stuff, then just needs to upload metadata at the end. Right. So that's a way that it hides some of the performance heavy tasks from a user to create this perceived performance of something that works really quickly, even though it takes a lot of time to upload images. And it'll put that picture that you've uploaded directly into your timeline the moment you click OK. So it looks to you like it's there. And that's a great way to kind of make a user feel as if something's fast, hide some of those performance things. You can do it with animation as well. There's a great talk again at JSConf about this that should be posted soon. But in terms of like response times, if you click on something, how long it takes for the interface to say, okay, I've acknowledged the fact that you have clicked on something, let me start working, or this is the response. If you've ever used FastClick or heard of FastClick, the JavaScript library, or the 300 millisecond delay on touchscreens, that is kind of a killer. It's because what you wind up happening is when you tap on something, if you have that 300 millisecond touch delay, that already exceeds what a user perceives as instantaneous. Mm-hmm. So we want to reduce that so that we can just start working immediately.
Right. So fast click kind of like just jury rigs it into it acts faster. Is that
correct? It jury rigs it so that it removes the 300 millisecond delay from tapping on something. And there are now a couple ways you can do it without a JavaScript library that aren't great. Mm-hmm. That's specifically for touch things.
Right.
But there are other instances like one of the recommendations that I've started giving, and the thing about performance is it's about our physiology as humans. It's like how we perceive the world. It's not something that's just we're entitled. So one of the recommendations I've started giving based on research into how humans work and based on research around performance and timing that other people have done is if an interface takes more than 300 milliseconds to respond, throw up a loading indicator. If it takes more than 3 seconds for something to respond, close the loading indicator, defer the task, and allow the user to subscribe to a notification for when it's ready for them to start working on it again, to allow them to keep going.
So what do you mean by that? Like send them an email or something? Or
email, push notification. We now have web notifications. That's kind of the advice that I've been giving recently. But don't keep a user waiting. The longer you keep a user waiting, the more likely it is that a user will forget what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
and get frustrated and just stop.
Right. Exactly. Okay. So performance as UX. So it's like page weight is an issue, but it's more like making sure they interact with your site and make sure that the, they can interact with your site faster and go through it faster, and it's not slowing them down. That's pretty good. Awesome. Yeah. Is there anything else about performance with that? Flash of unstyled content, and
there are a ton of things about performance. Probably too many to go into. But the talk from CSS from JSConf is great. One of my coworkers, Una Kravitz. Mm-hmm. Gives a great talk about performance. She actually gave one at BDConf this year with a former designer of ours named Ryan Brownhill. So kind of like the design and the development converging in that performance talk. And that's really where I love and where I live right now is kind of on the edge between design and engineering. Yeah. And I really love that because you need both to create a great user experience.
Right. And I love, that's what I love. I love the back end. I love the front end coming together and just merging as two. That's one of the things I love about web design. Like, and why I got into it was just because like, you need both, you know, I don't be like slam artists and programmers, but like, it's like nice being to use both sides of the brain and to build something really cool. Not that one needs, you know, you both need both sides of your brain. Rough things, but yeah, performance. And so it's like flash of unstyled content is just like this. It's kind of this thing where it's a boomerang thing where it's back in style to. It suits me to have it back in style. Like, yeah, we want to have content there, and then we wait for the web font to load, and then we'll just slam it back into the page. Is that true? Is that kind of the style right now?
So there are. I don't think anyone's figured out a way to do web fonts really well yet. Partially because of all of the things that we have on the web that give us like load events to trigger off of. We don't have one for fonts. We're getting like a font loading API in JavaScript, but it's not supported everywhere yet. Yeah. So for now, everyone's just kind of doing what they think is best. Mm-hmm. So for some people, it's letting a flash of unstyled text happen. And it also differs between browsers. So like Blink and WebKit, they'll make text invisible if they're downloading web fonts. Firefox will have it unstyled. No. I think it's Internet Explorer will have it unstyled and then switch to styling. Mm-hmm. Or maybe Firefox does that and Internet Explorer like waits a couple seconds and then it'll go to unstyled. And then if it finally loads and it'll go to styled, something like that. They all handle it a little bit differently. The way that I've started handling it is first page loads, no one gets web fonts. Right. And then loading them in the background and saving them to local storage. And then on subsequent page loads, if it's in local storage, load them from local storage, but have all the fonts base64 encoded in that. So it's a really big download that gets saved to local storage. But once it's there, it's there. And loading from local storage is about as fast as loading from cache. So you just switch it on. That's what I use on my personal website.
That's pretty awesome. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, I stole that from the Smashing Comp redesign. I think they did that.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And my buddy Ian Carrico does something similar on his website.
Yeah, because he's also speaking at SAS Summit about, he wrote a really cool blog post about how to build your own personal CDN. And he was trying to solve that type of a type of web font problem. Before. And I thought like this is an amazing article, and this is like, it's like, guys, you can have your own CDN for your own personal project or for your clients. It's like pretty awesome. So he's speaking at SAS Summit, but yeah, so challenges, you know, you find just performance as UX. Anything else? There doesn't have to be y'all like voices.
It's really bridging the design and developer divide, really, I think, is the biggest challenge. I've recently had kind of a change in mindset where thinking that the biggest challenges we have are technological challenges. And I've kind of realized that the biggest challenges that I see anyway are all person challenges. And I still see
Is it like just soft skills or just engineers versus designers, or
sometimes it's soft skills, sometimes it's organizational skill, or sometimes it's soft skill problems, sometimes it's organizational problems, sometimes it's hard skill problems. But it's being able to bridge the different skill sets. Back in the early days of web design, everyone did everything because everyone needed to do everything. And then we got very, very siloed in how we do work, with designers only doing design and developers only doing engineering.
Yeah, it was really weird. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we've actually had this conversation before. And the way that the convergence of responsive web design, what I've seen is we need to have more empathy for each other's deep skill sets, but we also need to grow our horizontal skill sets. It can't just be my silo and your silo. And we play really well together, but we play really well together through talking from different sandboxes. Mm-hmm. We actually need to play in the same sandbox. And you might be really, really good at digging in the sandbox, and I might be really, really good at sculpting, but we need to be playing in the same sandbox and be able to help each other. So I think the biggest challenges we have are organizational ones and people skill ones. I have a blog post about how we kind of tackled this for our team, because we had that problem on our team. And taking some of the lessons we learned from open source, and applying them to our day jobs. I think is immensely important, like social coding and transparency and communication. And just being excellent to each other. Like that's a thing we need to be better at. And I think, I think that's probably the biggest challenge for our industry.
Yeah. And that's, that comes from also from being, having really great managers or supervisors. I think also is just that, you know, the culture is very important for that to happen as well. Like you need to have a culture where it's not a me versus them mentality.
Yeah.
And so it's, and it kind of like, you know, the whole like phrase that, you know, S rolls down the hill, you know? So it's just like, if it's accepted on high, that, you know, like we need to take time out and to like, you know, do that pair, you know, design work or do the pair programming or whatever to like realize that if we work together for the same goal, you know, it's going to be beneficial to everyone. And you, you then you'd be able to build trust and to do great work and to be able to not just do great work, but just also to do like work that you would not expect you as a team, you know, to do that, that's beyond more than an individual, you know?
Yeah. So definitely. And
like, yeah,
I see it all the time. Like since we've gotten our team working kind of more collaboratively and everyone kind of built, we've built that trust now and we've built the trust to such a degree that our researcher and user experience designer started making HTML and code edits in our repository and she felt comfortable and safe doing that, which is fantastic. And I love that because then that means that we're working together as a team, not as a bunch of individual with specialties.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. That's, you know, that's awesome this year. So, yeah, so that's pretty awesome. They say like, you know, soft skills is important. And then just, you know, realizing there's other teams and people with other skill sets that you need to do. I mean, cause like, you know, your North documentation is like how many pages long, you know, you just can't, you know, everyone can't be a Sam, you know, just be awesome and be all things. So,
and I'm not even a Sam. Like a lot of the things that I write about in North are things that I've experienced, but can't necessarily do myself.
Right.
It's like, I can't design a website at all, but I've seen enough about design and I've worked enough with designers that I know about pitfalls and stuff like that.
Yeah. And like, speaking of like empathy for others, it's also like, I think, you know, I think like, if you don't mind me like dovetailing like that onto, you know, I was talking to Ari, who's like partner at Advice for Humans, is that, you know, we don't have this, like for Americans, I feel like, and it was just like, I'm still working on this analogy, but just like, we used to have Walter Cronkite. We used to have like Dan Rather to like tell us what's going on. And now we have this web, which is awesome, internet, but there's no like cultural touchstone that happens every night. I mean, I would say like Johnny Carson could have been that as well, you know? So, but then we have like, all we have now is the Super Bowl. it's our one thing, right? Like everyone's watching the Super Bowl or has heard of it. And we'll find out what the score is tomorrow, you know, like after the Super Bowl. So like, so everyone knows what's happening in the Super Bowl. Like there's no like one fixed point, like every day, because everyone's, you know, has devices and it has special things, you know, for, so there's no one thing. And so I feel like, it's just like in the article today about how Twitter used to be, could be awesome, but now it's a shouting match or a forum for abuse, which is, I love Twitter, you know, whatever. And I use it all the time, but you know, there's a lot of room for abuse and stuff like that. So I feel like, I mean, I wish there was like more empathy on the global scale to be able to for people online to know that, hey, not everyone is, you know, you don't have to like register your complaint to every little thing on the internet. So it's okay for that. Except for me, I can totally do that before for that, but especially for airlines. But and so that kind of like reminds me of our South by Southwest talk that we did this year. So,
yes, it does.
I'm not sure if you heard it or not, but we had it written as a special for the Non-Breaking Space, which is the dramatic readings from big issues and other nerdy things. And so, but so we actually got kind of snuck it from South by Southwest and was like, yeah, let's just run it. And it's an audio thing. And so I was really sick during that time, but I was really nervous because I'd never liked anything like that. But I still enjoyed it because it actually, it's like, it was your idea. Was it your idea? I'm not sure whose idea it was in the car, but it was just like, I just knew I heard it and it was your idea. And I was just like, oh my God, this is so awesome. We have to do this for South by Southwest. And so we just found all these weird bug issues where people just were not kind to one another.
Not at all.
And then they were just really just, they want things fixed or people to understand their point of view so much that they would just write these tirades on there. And I was just, so I was just feel like, oh man, I wish we could.
There's one of them from there that was just, someone was just so angry in the Compass issue queue, just so angry that he couldn't even. And I think the end of the post is, I don't expect a response. I just wanted to relieve myself. I think that's how that ended. And we have a tone analyzer API for Watson. And I went back through our talk to find all of these, to run them through the tone analyzer to see what Watson would pick up.
Oh man. So we didn't find anything or?
That post was angry and negative. Go figure.
Well, hopefully now the person has expelled that negative energy and has moved on.
They relieved themselves.
Yes, exactly. Cool. That was a fun, fun talk. So, cool. We talked about challenges. Is there anything like the challenges can be fun, but is there anything like you're really passionate about right now that you're tackling or looking at?
So one thing that I've recently started thinking about, the way that we define a front-end developer at IBM is someone kind of in four parts. HTML, CSS is kind of one part. JavaScript with frameworks, JavaScript without frameworks, and then non-browser JavaScript. And we specifically say non-browser as opposed to Node. Because one thing that I've been thinking about recently a lot, and it kind of comes from a couple of talks that Josh Clark gives. The first one I saw was Mind the Gap. The second one he's just started giving at an event apart, but I don't remember what its name is, about the Internet of Things and enchanted objects. And what does it mean to move our user interface from glass to a physical object? And for Watson, we do a lot of things in healthcare. We have a whole Watson Health initiative. But I can see things like education and law enforcement and so many different places where we can extend what we see on screen with physical objects. And I think it's really important to consider, to start thinking about how we can extend our user experience and how our user experience isn't just what someone sees, but the environment and the context that they're in, and how we can, as front-end developers, help to extend the user experience of these physical objects through IoT and stuff like that. So that's what I've been kind of like mulling over in my head recently, is what does that look like? What does that look like for the projects that I'm working on, but also what does that look like kind of for our industry? To really start putting a focus on that.
So anything you've come to terms with, or anything in particular that you've...
I like the idea so far. That's pretty much what I've come to terms with. This is something that literally has started churning for like a couple weeks now. But I like it, and I want to poke around in it a little bit more. I've been introduced to a lot of... I've been very fortunate that I was able to go to JSConf in May and be part of... work on the Node Robotics Day, and got to like actually build a robot in Node and see what it takes to build something physical using JavaScript. And it was really fun. So fun. I went out and bought a 3D printer and a bunch of other stuff to like support this terrible new habit of mine.
Oh man.
And I really want to start playing around with that.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome. Like I did a robotics course with, Cassandra Perch, I believe is her name. And so, just like a one afternoon course, and it was pretty awesome just to be able to build something, even so it was so minor, but just to be able to program it and just get working. So I thought it was pretty awesome. And then my nieces and nephews are building with Raspberry and, you know, Pi and all stuff. And I was just like, holy cow, that they were able to just, you know, so cheaply just build a computer and robots. So
yeah,
it's crazy. Crazy world. But cool. Awesome. Anything in the future you're excited about other than anything else?
Other than SaaSconf and SaaS Summit and all of the things.
All the things.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to see kind of, I've started doing a lot of organizational transformation work at the office. And I'm kind of excited to see how that goes and see if we can do some of this stuff that I've been talking about and hopefully be able to help others do that as well. And kind of start to see where we take this idea of the Internet of Things and extend that into user interfaces and not just Internet of Things-y type plop down things.
Like, what do you mean by plop down things?
Like iBeacons are an Internet of Things thing. Mm-hmm. Where you just kind of plop them down somewhere and then an interface reacts to the fact that that exists, but mm-hmm. kind of what the next step of Internet of Things are and how that reacts to the user interfaces I'm working on. So not an interface that reacts to a stationary thing, but an interface that reacts to something that someone's using.
Okay, cool.
So yeah, I'm interested in exploring those. I don't know where or how, but I'm interested to start exploring those and that should be fun.
Well, yeah. Is it anything like Alexa at all, or?
So Alexa to me is another one of those like IoT plop down things. It's a plop down IoT with a personal assistant,
right?
But it also does some home automation. So home automation is probably where I'm going to start playing with mm-hmm. initially, just to kind of like get my IoT feet wet. Mm-hmm. There was this amazing, JS Conf. Like talk in Berlin where someone used Post CSS and Node and JavaScript mm-hmm. to control the lighting rig for a whole room. Mm-hmm. And he was able to change the colors and change how all the lights worked through custom CSS properties. So he was basically writing CSS and doing all the lighting for the room. And that was awesome.
Yeah.
So starting to play with that and see how other people play with that. Because I think that in order for us to evolve our interfaces, we're going to need to go there. And I think that'll be fun to play with because that's a whole new era of things and a whole new system of things.
Right. I think that's that kind of scares me a little bit. It reminds me of the Simpsons episode where, the house from the future tries to kill the Simpsons. So I'm a little worried about that. But I also see the beauty of it too. So
yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Well, I think that's a good stopping point unless there's anything you want to add to the end.
No, just thanks for having me.
Oh, man. Thanks. It was a great conversation. Thank you so much for being here. And I will hope to talk to you soon.